Shit libs everywhere. A lot of them have been throwing out the idea that Trump's fascism is why we should vote for Biden. I keep telling them that we've had fascism for a long time, and this article today will make that point even clearer. But before I launch into that article with my scintillating commentary, I want to read a post by Joe Brunoli from a Facebook group I follow. He says that Bernie-crats who still support Bernie should actually hope that Biden does not win next month. Here's why. In the aftermath of the 2016 election, when the centrist Democrat Hillary Clinton had failed to beat Trump, the Democratic establishment famously refused to do a post-mortem to find out why they lost. Officially, their theory of the case was that the Russians had helped Trump win, and that the Trump base that had elected him were an irredeemable group of racists and white supremacists anyway. But in the back rooms and quiet hallways of power in D.C., the Democrats knew differently. They knew that their failure to attract Bernie supporters may have cost them the election. And the shitlibs on Twitter know this too. That was me. That is why they reacted to the loss by making Bernie part of the Senate Democratic leadership. On November 16th, just days after the massive electoral loss, Bernie Sanders was named chairman of outreach during a closed-door Senate Democratic caucus meeting. This was an obvious but very logical move to signal to Bernie's base that they still had a place in the Democratic Party. But things are different in 2020. 4 years ago, Hillary was very accommodating to both Bernie and his supporters. She actively tried to woo Bernie's base, and she even campaigned with Bernie. The two appeared many times together at events to demonstrate their cooperation and push for party unity. But there is nothing like that happening this year. In fact, just the opposite is happening. Joe Biden is running away from Bernie every chance he gets. He trashes Bernie in interviews and debates, saying, "I beat the socialist." He falls for the baiting tactic of the GOP, enthusiastically denouncing Bernie and AOC and asserting that they have no influence in the Democratic Party. Indeed, Biden sounded almost like Trump when he dismissed Bernie for the umpteenth time, saying, "I am the Democratic Party." And of course, he follows that up with a steady refrain of, "I am not a socialist." The Democrats and the Biden campaign have made a very conscious decision to place their electoral bets on winning over moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats and independents. They have made a determined effort to reject those on the left, young people, and blue-collar workers. In short, the Bernie base. In fact, it seems as if Biden is running against Bernie almost as much as he is running against Trump. If Biden wins with this strategy, the Democrats will crow that they won by attracting Republicans to their cause and that the American people believed Biden when he said the Democratic Party rejected Bernie and AOC and would instead follow Biden's lifetime example of conservatism and corporate-friendly policies. Many people have observed that if the Democrats win the Senate this year, Bernie Sanders will be head of the Senate Budget Committee. He is, after all, the ranking member of that committee currently, so this would seem to make sense. In fact, Republicans have campaigned on this very possibility. Lindsey Graham told a group of donors to dig deep because if the Senate flips to Democrats, Bernie Sanders is the Budget Committee chairman. But think about it. If Biden gets elected by saying that Bernie does not represent the party, if he thinks that he needs to sideline Bernie in order to maintain his support on the right, will he allow Bernie to ascend to such a powerful and high-profile position? No way. Remember, Bernie is not a Democrat. He is not an official member of the Democratic caucus, and he does not have any official seniority, power, or influence in that caucus. Everything that Bernie has, he has solely due to the good graces of Chuck Schumer and the rest of the Democratic leadership. And if Biden assumes power, the Democrats in the Congress will follow his lead. That is how DC works. Biden's White House staff will reflect the same neoliberal conservatism that Biden does. They will pressure the congressional leaders not to allow leftists like Bernie and AOC to occupy any sort of prominent or powerful position, lest the conservatives and the never-Trump Republicans point and shriek in horror, screaming that they have been tricked and betrayed by Biden, the Trojan horse for socialism. The best thing that true Bernie supporters can hope for is that the Democrats win the Senate but lose the White House. If that happens, we can expect that Bernie's star will rise as it did following the 2016 debacle. If, however, Biden wins with an openly anti-Bernie campaign, you can rest assured that Bernie will not be seen or heard from at all in the Senate for the next 4 years. Dude, I wonder if Bernie has figured this out yet. This is so obvious. By this logic, we would have been better off with Hillary because she courted Bernie and his supporters, and she would have had to act grateful had she won because people would assume that the reason she won was because she courted Bernie and his supporters. With Biden's strategy, which is completely the opposite, nobody has to give Bernie or his followers shit. Nobody has to give the squad shit. This is brilliant, Joe. There is no way that anyone should root for Biden to win if they're a Bernie supporter. Counterpunch. The U.S. did not defeat fascism in World War II. It discreetly internationalized it. By Gabriel Rockhill. The U.S. has established itself as the mortal enemy of all people's government, all scientific socialist mobilization of consciousness everywhere on the globe, all anti-imperialist activity on Earth. George Jackson. One of the founding myths of the contemporary Western European and American world is that fascism was defeated in World War II by liberal democracies, and particularly by the United States. With the subsequent Nuremberg trials and the patient construction of a liberal world order, a bulwark was erected, in fits and starts, and with the constant threat of regression against fascism and its evil twin in the East. American culture industries have rehearsed this narrative ad nauseum, brewing it into a saccharine ideological Kool-Aid and piping it into every household, shack, and street corner with a TV or smartphone, tirelessly juxtaposing the supreme evil of Nazism to the freedom and prosperity of liberal democracy. The material record suggests, however, that this narrative is actually based on a false antagonism and that a paradigm shift is necessary in order to understand the history of actually existing liberalism and fascism. The latter, as we shall see, far from being eradicated at the end of World War II, was actually repurposed, or rather redeployed, to serve its primary historical function, to destroy godless communism and its threat to the capitalist civilizing mission. Since the colonial projects of Hitler and Mussolini had become so brazen and erratic as they shifted from playing more or less by the liberal rules of the game to openly breaking them and then running amok, it was understood that the best way to construct the fascist international was to do so under liberal cover, meaning through clandestine operations that maintained a liberal facade. While this probably sounds like hyperbole to those whose understanding of history has been formatted by bourgeois social science, which focuses almost exclusively on visible government and the aforementioned liberal cover, the history of the invisible government of the national security apparatus suggests that fascism, far from being defeated in World War II, was successfully internationalized. This is me. I've read this article a few times, and I have to say that the more often, the more repeatedly I read it, the more brilliant it gets. We have been living in fascism since World War II, and the military intelligence complex of the UK and of the United States is why we're living in fascism. And the reason we don't see it is because we focus on the visible government rather than on the invisible government. People like Caitlin Johnstone have really figured this out. Back to the story. The architects of the fascist international. When the United States entered World War II, the future head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, bemoaned that his country was fighting the wrong enemy. The Nazis, as he explained, were pro-capitalist Aryan Christians, whereas the true enemy was godless communism and its resolute anti-capitalism. After all, the U.S. had, only some 20 years prior, been part of a massive military intervention in the USSR when 14 capitalist countries sought, in the words of Winston Churchill, to strangle the Bolshevik baby in its crib. Dulles understood, like many of his colleagues in the U.S. government, that what would later become known as the Cold War was actually the Old War, as Michael Parenti has convincingly argued. The one thing they had been fighting against communism since its inception. Towards the end of World War II, General Karl Wolff, formerly Himmler's right-hand man, went to see Alan Dulles in Zurich, where he was working for the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor organization to the CIA. Wolff knew that the war was lost, and he wanted to avoid being brought to justice. Dulles, for his part, wanted the Nazis in Italy under Wolff's command to lay down their arms against the Allies and help the Americans in their fight against communism. Wolff, who was the highest-ranking SS officer to survive the war, offered Dulles the promise of developing, with his Nazi team, an intelligence network against Stalin. It was agreed that the general who had played a central role in overseeing the Nazis' genocidal machine and who expressed his special joy when he secured freight trains to send 5,000 Jews a day to Treblinka would be protected by the future director of the CIA who helped him avoid the Nuremberg trials. Wolff was very far from being the only senior Nazi official protected and rehabilitated by the OSS-CIA. The case of Reinhard Gehlen is particularly telling. This general in the Third Reich had been in charge of Fremde Heere Ost, the Nazi intelligence service directed against the Soviets. After the war, he was recruited by the OSS-CIA and met with all of the major architects of the post-war national security state: Alan Dulles, William Donovan, Frank Wisner, President Truman. He was then appointed to head the first German intelligence service after the war, and he proceeded to employ many of his Nazi collaborators. The Gehlen Organization, as it was known, would become the nucleus of the German intelligence service. It is unclear how many war criminals this decorated Nazi hired, but Erich Lichtblau estimates that some 4,000 Nazi agents were integrated into the network overseen by the American spy agency. With an annual funding of $500,000 from the CIA in the early years after the war, Gehlen and his strongmen were able to act with impunity. Ivanek de Noël explained this turnaround with remarkable clarity. It is hard to understand that, as early as 1945, the Army and the U.S. intelligence services recruited without qualms former Nazi criminals. The equation was, however, very simple at the time. The United States had just defeated the Nazis with the help of the Soviets. They henceforth planned to defeat the Soviets with the help of former Nazis. The situation was similar in Italy because Dulles' agreement with Wolff was part of a larger undertaking called Operation Sunrise, which mobilized Nazis and fascists to end the Second World War in Italy and begin the Third World War across the globe. Dulles worked hand in hand with the agency's future chief counterintelligence officer, James Angleton, who was then stationed by the OSS in Italy. These two men, who would become two of the most powerful political actors of the 20th century, showed what they were capable of in this close collaboration between the American intelligence services, the Nazis, and the fascists. Angleton, on his end, recruited fascists to end the war in Italy so as to minimize the power of the communists. Valerio Borghese was one of his key contacts because this hardline fascist in Mussolini's regime was ready to serve the Americans in the anti-communist struggle, and he became one of the international figureheads for post-war fascism. Angleton had directly saved him from the hands of the communists, and the man known as the Black Prince was given the opportunity to continue the war against the radical left under a new boss, the CIA. So this is me talking. Now we know where all the anti-Russia hyperbole comes from. This is why we all keep getting called Russian agents. The fascistic international is fighting all of us on the left. Back to the story. Once the war was over, senior U.S. intelligence officials, including Dulles, Wisner, and Carmel Offey, worked to ensure that denazification only had a limited scope, according to Frédéric Charpier. Generals, senior officials, policemen, industrialists, lawyers, economists, diplomats, scholars, and real war criminals were spared and put back in their positions. The man in charge of the Marshall Plan in Germany, for instance, was a former advisor to Hermann Göring, the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, Air Force. Dulles drafted a list of high functionaries of the Nazi state to be protected and passed off as opponents to Hitler. the OSS-CIA proceeded to rebuild the administrative states in Germany and Italy with their anti-communist allies. Eric Lichtblau estimates that more than 10,000 Nazis were able to immigrate to the United States in the post-war period. At least 700 official members of the Nazi Party had been allowed into the U.S. in the 1930s, while Jewish refugees were being turned away. In addition to a few hundred German spies and thousands of SS personnel, Operation Paperclip, which began in May 1945, brought at least 1,600 Nazi scientists to the U.S. with their families. This undertaking was aimed at recovering the great minds of the Nazi war machine and putting their research on rockets, aviation, biological and chemical weapons, and so forth in the service of the American Empire. The Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency was set up specifically to recruit Nazis and find them positions in research centers, the government, the army, the intelligence services or universities. At least 14 universities participated, including Cornell, Yale, and MIT. Although the program officially excluded ardent Nazis, at least at the beginning, in actual fact it allowed for the immigration of chemists from IG Farben, which had supplied the deadly gases used in mass exterminations, scientists who had used slaves in concentration camps to make weapons, and doctors who had participated in hideous experiments on Jews, Roma, communists, homosexuals, and other prisoners of war. These scientists, who were described by an official in the State Department opposed to Paperclip as Hitler's angels of death, were received with open arms in the land of the free. They were given comfortable accommodations, a laboratory with assistance, and the promise of citizenship if their work bore fruit. They went on to conduct research that has been used in the manufacturing of ballistic missiles, sarin gas cluster bombs, and the weaponization of the bubonic plague. The CIA also collaborated with MI6 to set up secret anti-communist armies in every country in Western Europe. On the pretext of a potential invasion by the Red Army, the idea was to train and equip networks of illegal stay-behind soldiers who would remain behind enemy lines if the Russians moved westward. They would thus be activated in the newly occupied territory and charged with missions of exfiltration, espionage, sabotage, propaganda, subversion, and combat. The two agencies worked with NATO and the intelligence services of many Western European countries to build this vast sub rosa organization, establish numerous weapons and ammunition caches, and equip their soldiers of the shadows with everything they needed. To do this, they recruited Nazis, fascists, collaborationists, and other anti-communist members of the extreme right. The numbers vary according to the country, but they are estimated between a few dozen and several hundred, or even a few thousand, per country. According to a report from the television program Retour aux Sources, there were 50 stay-behind network units in Norway, 150 in Germany, more than 600 in Italy, and 3,000 in France. These trained militants would later be mobilized to commit or coordinate terrorist attacks against the civilian population, which were then blamed on the communists in order to justify law and order crackdowns. Wow. According to the official numbers in Italy, where this strategy of tension was particularly intense, there were 14,591 politically motivated acts of violence between 1969 and 1987, 1987? Which killed 491 people and injured 1,181. Vincenzo Vinci Guerra, now there's a name for you, Vinci Guerra, conquering warrior, a member of the far-right group Ordine Nuovo and the perpetrator of the bombing near Petteano in 1972, explained that the fascist Avanguardia Nazionale, like Ordine Nuovo, were being mobilized into the battle as part of an anti-communist strategy originating not with organizations deviant from the institutions of power, but from the state itself, and specifically from within the ambit of the state's relations within the Atlantic Alliance. An Italian parliamentary commission that undertook an investigation of the stay-behind armies in Italy reached the following conclusion in 2000. Those massacres, those bombs, those military actions had been organized or promoted or supported by men inside Italian state institutions and has been discovered more recently by men linked to the structures of United States intelligence. The U.S. national security state was also involved in overseeing rat lines that exfiltrated fascists from Europe and allowed them to resettle in safe havens around the world in exchange for doing its dirty work. The case of Klaus Barbie is but one among thousands, but it speaks volumes regarding the internal functioning of this process. Known in France as the Butcher of Lyon, he was head of the Gestapo office there for 2 years, including the time when Himmler gave the order to deport at least 22,000 Jews from France. This specialist in enhanced interrogation tactics, known for torturing to death the coordinator of the French resistance, Jean Moulin, organized the first roundup of the General Union of Jews in France in February 1943 and the massacre of 41 Jewish refugee children in Izieux in April 1944. Before arriving in Lyon, he had led savage death squads, which had killed more than 1 million people on the Eastern Front, according to Alexander Cockburn and Geoffrey St. Clair. But after the war, the man whom these same authors describe as third on the most wanted list of SS criminals was working for the Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, of the U.S. Army. He was hired to help build the stay-behind armies by recruiting other Nazis and to spy on French intelligence services in the French and American-controlled regions in Germany. When France learned what was happening and demanded Barbie's extradition, John McCloy, the U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, refused by claiming that the allegations were based on hearsay. Nevertheless, it ultimately proved too expensive, symbolically, to keep a butcher like Barbie in Europe, so he was sent to Latin America in 1951, where he was able to continue his illustrious career. Settling in Bolivia, he worked for the security forces of the military dictatorship of General René Barrientos and for the Ministry of the Interior and the counterinsurgency wing of the Bolivian army under the dictatorship of Hugo Banzer before actively participating in the cocaine coup in 1980 and becoming the director of security forces under General Meza. Throughout his career, he maintained close relationships with his saviors in the U.S. national security state, playing a central role in Operation Condor, the counterinsurgency project that brought together Latin American dictatorships with the support of the United States to violently crush any attempt at egalitarian uprisings from below. He also helped develop the drug empire in Bolivia, including organizing gangs of narco mercenaries whom he named Los Novios de la Muerte, whose uniforms resembled those of the SS. He traveled freely in the 1960s and 70s, visiting the U.S. at least 7 times, and he most likely played a role in the manhunt organized by the agency to kill Ernesto Che Guevara. The same basic pattern of integrating fascists into the global war against communism is readily identifiable in Japan, whose system of government prior to and during the war has been described by Herbert P. Bix as Emperor System Fascism. Tessa Morris Suzuki has convincingly demonstrated the continuity of intelligence services by detailing how the U.S. national security state oversaw and managed the Cato organization. This private intelligence network, very much like the Galen organization, was stocked with former leading members of the military and intelligence services, including the Imperial Army's Chief of Intelligence, Arisu Saizo, who shared with his American handler, Charles Willoughby, a deep admiration for Mussolini. The U.S. occupation forces also cultivated tight relationships with senior officials in Japan's wartime civilian intelligence community, most notably Ogata Taketora. This remarkable continuity between pre-war and post-war Japan has led Morris Suzuki and other scholars to map Japanese history in terms of a trans-war regime, meaning one that continued from before to after the war. This concept also allows us to make sense of what was happening above ground in the realm of the visible government. For the sake of concision, suffice it to cite the remarkable case of the man known as the Devil of Showa for his brutal rule of Manchukuo, the Japanese colony in northeast China, Nobusuke Kishi. A great admirer of Nazi Germany, Kishi was appointed Minister of Munitions by Prime Minister Hideki Tojo in 1941 in order to prepare Japan for a total war against the US. And he was the one who signed the official declaration of war against America. After serving a brief prison term as a war criminal in the post-war era, he was rehabilitated by the CIA along with his cellmate, the kingpin of organized crime, Yoshio Kodama. Kishi, with the support and generous financial backing of his handlers, took over the Liberal Party, made it into a right-wing club of former leaders of Imperial Japan, and rose to become prime minister. The CIA money flowed for at least 15 years under four American presidents, writes Tim Vina, and it helped consolidate one-party rule in Japan for the rest of the Cold War. U.S. National Security Services have also established a global educational network to train pro-capitalist combatants, sometimes under the leadership of experienced Nazis and fascists, in the tried and true techniques of repression, torture, and destabilization, as well as propaganda and psychological warfare. The famous School of the Americas was established in 1946 with the explicit goal of training a new generation of anti-communist warriors worldwide. According to some, this school has the distinction of having educated the greatest number of dictators in world history. Whatever the case may be, it is part of a much larger institutional network. It is worth mentioning, for example, the educational contributions of the public safety program. For about 25 years, writes former CIA officer John Stockwell, the CIA trained and organized police and paramilitary officers from around the world in techniques of population control, repression, and torture. Schools were set up in the United States, Panama, and Asia, from which tens of thousands graduated. In some cases, former Nazi officers from Hitler's Third Reich were used as instructors. And now, dear listeners and viewers, we get to the real point. Fascism goes global under liberal cover. The American Imperium has thus played a central role in the construction of a fascist international by protecting right-wing militants and enlisting them in the Third World War against communism, an elastic label extended to any political orientation that entered into conflict with the interests of the capitalist ruling class. So now you know what godless communism is. It's anything that comes into conflict with the interests of the capitalist ruling class. That's why, dear viewers and listeners, we should be proud to be called communists, if anyone ever calls us that. This international expansion of fascist modes of governance has led to a proliferation of concentration camps, terrorist and torture campaigns, dirty wars, dictatorial regimes, vigilante groups, and organized crime networks around the world. The examples could be enumerated ad nauseum, but I will curtail them in the interests of space and simply invoke the testimony of Victor Marchetti, who was a senior CIA official from 1955 to 1969. We were supporting every half-assed dictator, military junta, oligarchy that existed in the Third World as long as they promised to somehow maintain the status quo, which would of course be beneficial to U.S. geopolitical interests, military interests, big business interests, and other special interests. The record of U.S. foreign policy since World War II is probably the best measure of its unique contribution to the internationalization of fascism. Under the banner of democracy and freedom, the United States has, according to William Blum, endeavored to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments, grossly interfered in democratic elections in at least 30 countries, attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on the people of more than 30 countries, attempted to suppress a populist or nationalist movement in 20 countries. The Association for Responsible Dissent, composed of 14 former CIA officers, now that's interesting. I always knew there had to be good guys inside the CIA who wanted to get out, without getting their heads chopped off, of course. Anyway, the Association for Responsible Dissent, composed of 14 former CIA officers, calculated that their agency was responsible for killing a minimum of 6 million people in 3,000 major operations and 10,000 minor operations between 1947 and 1987. I don't know about you other old timers, but that is weird to see the number 1987, which is in clear memory. If you ever trusted these motherfuckers, you should probably stop now. These are direct murders, so the numbers do not account for premature deaths under the fascist-backed capitalist world system due to mass incarceration, torture, malnutrition, lack of drinkable water, exploitation, oppression, social degradation, ecological illness, or curable disease. Fuck, they do that to the people in Flint, Michigan right now. In 2017, according to the UN, 6.3 million children and young adolescents died from avoidable causes linked to the socioeconomic and ecological inequalities of the Capital Ocean, which amounts to one child dying every 5 seconds. That's in 2017. To establish itself as the global military hegemon and international guard dog of capitalism, the U.S. government and national security state have relied on the help of the significant number of Nazis and fascists it integrated into its global network of repression, including the 1,600 Nazis brought into the U.S. through Operation Paperclip, the 4,000 or so integrated into the Galen Organization, the tens or even hundreds of thousands that were reintegrated into the post-war, or rather trans-war, regimes in fascist countries, the large number who were given free passage to Empire's backyard, Latin America, and elsewhere, as well as the thousands or tens of thousands integrated into NATO's secret stay-behind armies. This global network of seasoned anti-communist assassins has also been used to train armies of terrorists around the world to participate in dirty wars, coup d'etat, destabilization efforts, sabotage, and terror campaigns. All of this has been done under the cover of a liberal democracy and with the assistance of its powerful culture industries. That means Hollywood. The true legacy of World War II, far from being that of a liberal world order that had defeated fascism, is that of a veritable fascist international developed under liberal cover in order to try and destroy those who had actually fought and won the war against fascism, the communists. Gabriel Rockhill is a Franco-American philosopher, cultural critic, and activist. He is the founding director of the Critical Theory Workshop and professor of philosophy at Villanova University. His books include Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology Democracy, 2017, Interventions in Contemporary Thought, History, Politics, Aesthetics, 2016, Radical History and the Politics of Art, 2014, and Logique de l'Histoire, 2010. In addition to his scholarly work, he has been actively engaged in extra-academic activities in the art and activist worlds, as well as a regular contributor to public intellectual debate. Follow on Twitter, at Gabriel Rockhill. So, dear viewers and listeners, you know what to share with people if they start talking about fascism, particularly if they start talking about Trump's fascism. The kind of fascism we need to combat has very little to do with Donald Trump.